Welcome to the Vital Signs podcast from Jones and Bartlett Publishers. Vital Signs is a continuing education series for EMS providers that helps satisfy state and national certification or licensure requirements. Each episode provides current information on specific areas of emergency medical care. Stay tuned at the end of the show to find out how you can earn continuing education credits. HIV Update 2006. This learning module presents information about the human immunodeficiency virus and acquired immune deficiency syndrome. During the period of 1850 to 1900, acute infectious diseases were the main focus of our nation's collective health efforts. With advances in technology, discovery of antibiotics, and the infusion of science into medicine, infectious diseases have largely been brought under reasonable control. Subsequently, the predominant area of concern has shifted to chronic diseases such as cardiovascular disorders and cancer. Despite this trend away from epidemics of mass proportions, diseases that can be spread from one individual to another remain prevalent throughout the world. The problem is so severe that human immunodeficiency virus, HIV infection, and the transition to full-blown acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, have become major causes of mortality around the globe. In fact, data from the year 2000 indicate that approximately 448,000 deaths in the United States alone were caused by these infectious diseases. By killing or damaging cells of the body's immune system, HIV progressively destroys the body's ability to fight infections and certain cancers. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome was first reported in the United States in 1981 and has since become a major worldwide epidemic. People diagnosed with AIDS can contract life-threatening diseases called opportunistic infections that are caused by microbes such as viruses or bacteria that usually do not make healthy people sick. HIV infection and AIDS remain major epidemics with worldwide distribution. Every healthcare provider must therefore have an understanding of the impact of these diseases, how they are transmitted, what protective measures should be initiated, and what actions should be taken following a significant exposure. This module presents facts regarding these immune-disabling diseases, along with universal guidelines to prevent infection. Objectives. Objectives for this module include the following. Discuss relevant epidemiology for HIV and AIDS. Describe the virology of the human immunodeficiency virus. State the tests used to determine HIV infection. List the symptoms of HIV infection. Define acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Objectives. Additional objectives include the following. List the clinical complications of HIV/AIDS, including these. Cutaneous symptoms. Pulmonary involvement. Other common manifestations. State the occupational exposure facts. State important legal issues in terms of possible or known exposure to HIV. Epidemiology. According to data available from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, approximately 800,000 to 900,000 persons are living with HIV infection in our nation, with new cases occurring daily. Up to one quarter of these people are unaware of their infection. The highest rates for new infections are for the male population, 70% of annual new infections. In terms of risk categorization, men who engage in homosexual intercourse make up 42% of new infections, whereas the remaining 58% is attributed to heterosexual intercourse and injection drug use, 33% and 25% respectively. There is a notable difference in distribution among races, with more than half of new HIV cases occurring among blacks, 54%. The available data show that the infection rate for whites is 26%, Hispanics 19%. The last 1% of cases fall into the miscellaneous category. Epidemiology. The chart depicted here is a graphic representation of the estimated incidence of AIDS and deaths of adults with AIDS in the United States from 1985 to June 1999. The yellow line depicts the number of reported AIDS cases, whereas the blue line indicates the deaths that resulted from AIDS. Note that in 1993, A new definition of AIDS was implemented, which caused a relative decline in the number of reported cases. Epidemiology. Healthcare workers are also among those infected with HIV. Recent surveillance information from CDC shows that 73% of healthcare workers with AIDS, including 1,384 physicians, 88 surgeons, 3,856 nurses, 378 dental workers, and 317 paramedics, have died as a consequence of the infection. There were 57 reported cases of HIV seroconversion resulting from occupational exposure. 45.6% of those infected with HIV developed AIDS. Exposure causes ranged from percutaneous, i.e. needle stick, 84.2%, by mucous membrane and or skin, 8.7%, by a combination of both, 3.5%, to an unknown route, 3.5%. The vast majority of the exposures resulted from contact with HIV-infected blood, 84.2%. Epidemiology. The most common route of becoming infected with HIV is by having unprotected sex with an infected partner. The virus can enter the body through the lining of the vagina, vulva, penis, rectum, or mouth during sex. Having a sexually transmitted disease such as syphilis, genital herpes, chlamydia, gonorrhea, or bacterial vaginosis appears to make people more susceptible to getting HIV infection during sex with infected partners. HIV is also frequently spread among intravenous drug users who share needles contaminated with blood. In the past, receiving transfusions with blood products was another common route of becoming infected with HIV. HIV by transfusion has become rare in developed countries since the initiation of voluntary deferral of donors at risk for HIV infection and routine HIV antibody testing of all donations. Continued improvement in donor recruitment practices, donor education, donor screening, and blood testing has resulted in continued decreases in the risk of transfusion transmission of HIV. In 1995, the risk in the United States of HIV-1 transmission per unit transfused was estimated to be between 1 in 450,000 and 1 in 660,000. By 2003, this estimated risk had decreased to between 1 in 1.4 million and 1 in 1.8 million units. Epidemiology. HIV transmission from women to their babies during pregnancy or delivery can happen approximately 25% of the time if the mothers are not treated. HIV also can be spread to babies through the breast milk of mothers infected with a virus. If the mother is treated with a drug AZT, zidovudine, and the baby is delivered by cesarean section, the risk of transmission of HIV to the newborn is about 1%. Although HIV can be found in saliva, saliva has not been shown to be a mode of transmission. Experimental evidence seems to show that the properties of saliva limit the ability of HIV to infect, and that there is no evidence that HIV can be acquired by kissing. There also appears to be no evidence of spread of HIV by sweat, tears, urine, or feces. Casual activities such as sharing eating utensils, towels, bedding, toilets, and telephones also carry no risk. Contrary to a once popular myth, mosquitoes cannot transmit the virus. Virology. HIV is made of ribonucleic acid, RNA, and must invade a host cell to replicate. This particular virus belongs to a family known as retroviruses, so named because they work in reverse of typical mechanisms for reproduction. For example, the human somatic cells use the oxyribonucleic acid, DNA, to make strands of RNA. A retrovirus does exactly the opposite. RNA, combined with a special enzyme known as reverse transcriptase, works to make DNA. Once the DNA is produced, the virus is able to replicate. HIV has a spherical shape with a diameter of 10 to the minus 3rd millimeters. It has an envelope composed of two layers of lipids, which collectively serve as the outer coat of the virus. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a division of the National Institutes of Health, has conducted research that shows that HIV can travel through parts of the human cell membrane known as lipid rafts. These regions of the cell might be future targets for intervention strategies. Virology. To understand how HIV infection produces AIDS, you must first understand some basic principles of how the normal immune system functions. There are two types of specific immunity within the body, humoral and cell-mediated. Humoral immunity involves B cells that produce antibodies to fight infection. Cell-mediated immunity is derived from T cells that are generated from the thymus gland in the thorax. In contrast to B cells, T cells directly attack invading pathogens. However, they must be signaled to action. The HIV virus attacks the messenger of the immune system, thereby effectively preventing T cells from becoming activated. HIV begins its infection of a susceptible host cell by binding to the CD4 receptor on T cells. After binding with a receptor, HIV is able to gain entry into the cell. The genetic material of the virus, which is RNA, is converted into DNA by an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. Inhibitors of this enzyme, such as AZT, were the first anti-HIV medications and are still a critical part of treating patients who have HIV. Once the genetic material of HIV has been changed into DNA, this viral DNA enters the host cell nucleus, where it can be integrated into the genetic material of the cell. The viral DNA might lay dormant in the infected cell for many years. Because viral DNA can exist in an inactive state for a prolonged period of time, current treatment is not able to eliminate HIV from an infected individual completely, and a patient is required to remain on antiviral medications for life. Virology. When the host cell is activated, viral DNA controls the construction of viral RNA and viral proteins. The new viral RNA forms the genetic material of the next generation of viruses. Viral RNA and viral proteins assemble at the cell membrane into a new virus. Among the viral proteins is HIV protease, which is required to process other HIV proteins into their functional forms. Protease inhibitors, one of the most potent types of antiviral medications, act by blocking this critical maturation step. Following assembly at the cell's surface, the virus then buds forth from the cell and is released to infect another cell. Virology. Unless the HIV life cycle is interrupted by treatment, the virus infection spreads throughout the body and results in the destruction of the body's immune system. With current antiviral medications, such as reverse transcriptase inhibitors and protease inhibitors, HIV infection can be contained. However, a great deal more must be achieved before the AIDS epidemic is brought under control. One important immediate goal is to design new, more potent medications that are easier to take and have fewer side effects. However, the ultimate challenges are to use our understanding of the HIV life cycle to develop medications that will eradicate HIV from people who are already infected, and to create a vaccine that will prevent new infections in the future. Diagnosis. HIV infection is most commonly established by testing the subject's blood. Initial screening uses an enzyme-linked serum immunoassay, ELISA, which detects serum antibodies to HIV antigens. If this test is positive, it is then confirmed with a Western blot test. The Western blot technique detects viral antigens in the patient's serum. Overall sensitivity and specificity of HIV serology is greater than 99.9%. False negative HIV tests are accounted for primarily by testing performed during the window period, usually the first several months of acute infection after viral transmission, but before the appearance of antibodies. Of these cases, 95% become positive by 3 months and 98% by 6 months. False positive test results can occur in children less than 6 months of age, in whom a positive test result can be caused by transplacentally acquired antibodies. Another test becoming more commonly used is the SUDS test, which is similar to the ELISA screening test and can be performed in less than 1 hour. This test is now becoming standard in the management of occupational exposures to help guide decisions in the use of post-exposure prophylaxis. Studies have demonstrated sensitivities of 100% and specificity ranging from 93% to 99%. HIV infection symptoms. Many people do not have any symptoms when they first become infected with HIV. Some people, however, have a flu-like illness within a month or two after exposure to the virus. This illness may include the following: fever, headache, tiredness, enlarged lymph nodes. These symptoms usually disappear within a week to a month and are often mistaken for those of another viral infection. During this period, people are very infectious, and HIV is present in large quantities in genital fluids. More persistent or severe symptoms may not appear for 10 years or more after HIV first enters the body in adults, or within 2 years in children born with HIV infection. This period of asymptomatic infection is highly individual. Some people might begin to have symptoms within a few months, while others can be symptom-free for more than 10 years. HIV infection symptoms. Even during the asymptomatic period, the virus is actively multiplying, infecting, and killing cells of the immune system. The most obvious effect of HIV infection is a decline in the number of CD4-positive T cells, also called T4 cells, found in the blood, a key part of the immune system. Early on in the infection, the virus can destroy T cells without causing symptoms. As immune function declines, a variety of signs and symptoms can occur. Frequently, the first signs of infection are persistently enlarged lymph nodes. Other symptoms, often experienced months to years before the onset of AIDS, include these: lack of energy, weight loss, frequent fevers and sweats, persistent or frequent yeast infections, oral or vaginal, persistent skin rashes or flaky skin, pelvic inflammatory disease in women that does not respond to treatment, short-term memory loss. AIDS. HIV infection by itself does not mean AIDS. CDC's definition of AIDS includes all HIV-infected people who have fewer than 200 CD4-positive T cells per cubic millimeter of blood. Healthy adults usually have CD4-positive T cell counts of 1,000 or more. In addition, the definition includes 26 clinical conditions that affect people with advanced HIV disease. Most of these conditions are opportunistic infections that generally do not affect healthy people. In people with AIDS, these infections are often severe and sometimes fatal because the immune system is so degraded by HIV that the body cannot fight off certain bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, and other microbes. Clinical complications. Several skin disorders are associated with HIV/AIDS. Generalized cutaneous complaints such as xerosis, dry skin, and pruritus are common and can be present before any of the AIDS-defining illnesses. Other common rashes such as cellulitis, herpes simplex, herpes zoster, shingles, and syphilis are found with increased frequency in patients with AIDS. Herpes zoster frequently prompts patients to seek emergency care because of its very painful rash, which occurs in a band-like dermatomal distribution. This is caused by the chickenpox virus, which lays dormant for many years after its primary infection, only to erupt later in a skin nerve root. Clinical complications. Kaposi sarcoma is the second most common manifestation of AIDS and has involved approximately 25% of the known cases to date. It is found commonly among homosexual or bisexual men. The disease is usually widely disseminated with mucous membrane involvement, although rarely primarily fatal. The typical appearance of cutaneous involvement is pink, red, or purple raised lesions. Treatment of Kaposi's sarcoma is based on sites and extent of involvement and can include cryotherapy, freezing, radiation, or local or systemic chemotherapy. Clinical complications. Oral candidiasis, thrush, affects more than 80% of AIDS patients. It represents a fungal infection by Candida albicans, the most common fungal infection in HIV-infected patients. Typical involvement includes the tongue, palate, and buccal mucosa. Symptoms may include soreness, burning, and difficulty swallowing, although it can be asymptomatic. Most oral lesions can be managed with topical antifungal medications such as nystatin. This infection can involve the esophagus, esophageal candidiasis, and is the most common esophageal problem in the HIV patient, causing painful swallowing and chest pain. Clinical complications. Pulmonary manifestations of HIV are among the most common reasons for emergency department visits among AIDS patients. The differential diagnosis of respiratory involvement is broad and includes such etiologies as typical community-acquired bacterial infections, tuberculosis, viral, fungal, or protozoal infections, pneumocystis pneumonia, and malignancies, Kaposi's sarcoma, and lymphoma. Patients can present with fever, cough, and shortness of breath. Hemoptysis, coughing blood, is often associated with bacterial pneumonia and tuberculosis. Hypoxia may be quite pronounced with pneumocystis infections. PCP is the most common opportunistic infection in AIDS. Pneumocystis almost always affects the lungs. Those most at risk are those with CD4 cell counts under 200. The first signs of PCP are difficulty breathing, fever, and a dry cough. More than 80% of AIDS patients acquire PCP at some time during their illness, and it is the initial opportunistic infection in 60% of cases. The organism responsible for PCP has traditionally been classified as a protozoa. However, many authorities now consider it to behave more like a fungus. Untreated, PCP is fatal. However, now there are good preventive medications and treatments. Treatments include sulfa drugs such as Bactrim, sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, and steroids if the patient has severe hypoxia. Clinical complications. Tuberculosis, TB, is an infection caused by a bacterium known as Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Worldwide, TB has become a very serious problem, with almost one-third of the world population infected. However, infection does not mean active disease, because a healthy immune system can prevent clinical disease. The rate of TB for people with HIV in the United States is 40 times the rate for people who aren't HIV infected. The incidence of TB has dramatically increased in the HIV population, especially among the poor, prisoners, and IV drug users. TB can be the first indication that a patient has AIDS, and it commonly presents with fever, weight loss, night sweats, cough of prolonged duration greater than 3 weeks, and hemoptysis, coughing up blood. TB usually affects the lungs, but can cause infections of other organs. TB is typically transmitted by aerosolized particles after someone with TB coughs or sneezes. There are two kinds of active TB. Primary TB occurs soon after a person is first exposed to TB. Reactivation TB occurs in people who were previously exposed to TB. If their immune system is weakened, TB can break out of the tubercles and cause active disease. Most of the cases of TB in people with HIV disease are caused by reactivation of a previous TB infection. Clinical complications. The test for TB consists of injecting a protein found in the bacteria just under the skin. A positive reaction causes the skin to swell at the site of injection and is indicative of exposure to the bacteria, not necessarily active disease. Active disease is confirmed with a chest X-ray and cultures that grow TB from the sputum. It is possible for those with HIV to be infected with TB and not to test positive for the skin test. This is because the fact that a weakened immune system might not be able to mount enough of a reaction to the TB protein to cause swelling at the injection site. A positive TB test in an asymptomatic patient with a normal chest X-ray will typically be treated with a single drug for 6 months or multiple drugs for 3 months. Active disease is treated with multiple drugs for at least 6 months. Of great concern is the fact that multiple drug-resistant TB is becoming more common in the HIV population. Clinical complications. Neurologic diseases are the initial manifestation of AIDS in 10% to 20% of patients. The frequency of neurologic complications increases over the course of HIV infection, with up to a 75% to 90% prevalence of neurologic disorders in patients with AIDS. Neurologic disease can be caused by a variety of opportunistic infections and neoplasms, as well as direct effects of HIV infection on the central nervous system, CNS. The most common AIDS-defining neurologic complications are HIV encephalopathy, dementia, Cryptococcus neoformans, toxoplasmosis, and primary CNS lymphoma. The most common presenting symptoms indicative of CNS pathology are seizures, meningismus, focal neurologic deficits, altered mental status, and headache, new or persistent. Infection accounts for the vast majority of neurologic presentations and is most often accompanied by fever. Clinical complications. AIDS dementia complex, or HIV encephalopathy, occurs in up to one-third of patients with HIV. It is a progressive process caused by direct HIV infection and commonly starts with impairment of recent memory or subtle cognitive deficits, such as difficulty concentrating. Deficits become more debilitating in later stages of disease and can include more obvious changes in mental states and seizures. The fungal infection, Cryptococcus neoformans, can occur in up to 10% of AIDS patients and typically causes a form of meningitis, meningoencephalitis. The most common presenting symptoms are fever and headache, often accompanied by nausea and vomiting. Clinical complications. Toxoplasma gondii is a parasite that can infect the brain, causing headache, fever, altered mental status, seizures, and focal deficits, found in up to 80% of the cases. These focal deficits can be easily confused with stroke, but the onset is usually gradual. Brain-computed tomography, CT scans, can differentiate toxoplasmosis from cerebrovascular accident, CVA, because the former typically displays ring lesions that enhance with intravenous contrast, whereas CVA does not. Clinical complications. Eye problems are common in HIV/AIDS patients. HIV patients can develop retinal infections caused by the cytomegalovirus, CMV. CMV retinitis occurs in 10% to 30% of HIV-infected patients and is the most common cause of blindness in AIDS patients. Diarrhea is the most common gastrointestinal complaint for AIDS patients and is estimated to occur in 50% to 90%. Diarrhea can vary in severity from a few loose stools per day to massive fluid loss with severe weakness, fever, chills, and weight loss. Potential pathogens include parasites, Cryptosporidium parvum, Enterocytosone bienussi, Isospora belli, Giardia lamblia, Entamoeba histolytica, Microsporidia, Cyclospora, and others. Bacteria: Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, Helicobacter pylori, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, Mycobacterium avium complex, Clostridium difficile, and others. Viruses, cytomegalovirus, herpes simplex, HIV, and others. And fungi, Histoplasma capsulatum, Cryptococcus neoformans, Coccidioides immitus, and others. Significant gastrointestinal bleeding and dehydration have been associated with many pathogens, particularly CMV. Occupational exposures. Healthcare workers should always practice the use of universal standard precautions when providing care for all patients. The Bloodborne Pathogen Standard from Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, is very specific about the mandatory utilization of universal standard precautions. Education must be available within 10 days of employment to all employees whose job description requires them to perform tasks that could expose them to bloodborne pathogens. No recapping, bending, or breaking of sharps is allowed. The use of appropriate personal protective equipment, PPE, is required and must be made available to all employees. OSHA also requires employers to have a system available to assist employees who are injured by sharps on the job. Testing for bloodborne pathogens must be available for those employees who sustain significant exposures, percutaneous, blood splashes, or blood that enters non-intact skin. After significant exposure, the source and the exposed healthcare worker should receive counseling and testing in accordance with federal and state laws. All documentation concerning the exposure must be placed confidentially in the employee's health record. Once testing has been accomplished on the source, the results can be given to the source and the exposed healthcare worker. The results of the source must be kept confidential by all involved, including the exposed healthcare worker. Occupational exposures. The risk for a healthcare worker acquiring HIV from percutaneous exposure, needle stick, is usually 1 in 300. After mucous membrane exposure, the risk is 1 in 3,000. And on non-intact skin, the risk is very small. As of December 2001, the CDC had received voluntary reports of 57 documented cases of HIV seroconversion associated with occupational exposure among U.S. healthcare personnel. An additional 138 infections among healthcare personnel were considered possible cases of occupational HIV transmission. With present reliable source testing, if the test result is negative, the risk of transmission is assumed to be zero. Post-exposure. The CDC reported in one study that if healthcare providers are treated with zidovudine AZT for an exposure, there was an 81% reduction in the risk of HIV infection. However, the protection is not absolute, because there has been 21 cases of HIV infection reported despite post-exposure prophylactic treatment. Side effects from the antiviral drugs are common. Almost half of all healthcare personnel reported some adverse events while taking the drugs. And although the side effects are not considered serious, nearly one-third of the people stopped the drugs because of them. The CDC document recommends that those persons exposed to bloody needle sticks and bloody splashes should usually be treated with 3 HIV medications. The prophylaxis must occur no later than 1 to 2 hours after exposure. If a rapid HIV test is available and the source tests negative, the medication is unnecessary. However, if the source is positive, medication should be administered for 28 days. This chart lists the recommended HIV post-exposure prophylaxis treatments for needle stick injuries. Exposure types are broken down into less severe and more severe. An example of a less severe exposure would be an abrasion by a needle, whereas a more severe exposure would be deep penetration into the skin. The HIV positive category also has 2 divisions, Class 1 and Class 2. Class 1 infections are less severe compared to Class 2. There are treatment options if the source is deceased or unknown. Note that in both the less and more severe exposure categories, No treatment is recommended if the source tests negative for HIV. This chart is used when a mucous membrane or non-intact skin exposure occurs. On the left are the categories small and large volume. A few drops of blood is considered small, and saturation is considered large. The same two classes listed at the top from the previous chart are again used to rate the severity of source infection. Also noted are guidelines for a source with unknown HIV status, unknown source, and an HIV negative source. Post-exposure actions. If you are exposed during the course of patient care, you should take some important actions. For a needle stick or other percutaneous exposure, be sure to render first aid as needed, including bleeding control. According to the Centers for Disease Control, wounds and skin sites that have been in contact with blood or body fluids should be washed with soap and water. Mucous membranes should be flushed with water. No evidence exists that using antiseptics for wound care or expressing fluid by squeezing the wound further reduces the risk of blood-borne pathogen transmission. However, the use of antiseptics is not contraindicated. The application of caustic agents, e.g. bleach, or the injection of antiseptics or disinfectants into the wound is not recommended. Post-exposure actions. Should a significant exposure occur, report it immediately to your supervisor. Complete an exposure form to maintain adequate records of the incident. Request blood testing for both patient and provider. For additional information, the Clinician's Post-Exposure Prophylaxis Hotline, PEP Line, is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 1-888-448-4911. Legal issues. Most states require that patients must give consent before testing is done. Some persons can be tested without consent, such as those arrested for prostitution. Cadavers. Those involved in criminal acts where blood and other bodily fluids might have exposed police, other emergency workers, or citizens, and those serving in the military. Minors older than age 12 can usually be tested for HIV without parental consent, protected under the STDs laws. Healthcare workers cannot be fired because of their HIV status. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, provides protection against this. Licensed healthcare workers usually have the right to know a patient's HIV status so they can assist with the medical management of the patient. Information can be shared with other licensed healthcare workers who are also involved in the medical management of the HIV patient. Healthcare workers cannot deny care to HIV-positive persons. If they do not have the medical expertise, they must refer the patient to other medical professionals that can assist the patient. Pearls and pitfalls. Although societal attitudes continue to evolve, patients with HIV/AIDS can still find themselves marginalized and isolated. Although in many cases there is little EMS personnel can offer in direct medical intervention to the patient with HIV/AIDS, it is paramount that care be delivered with compassion and in a non-judgmental manner. An understanding of the mechanism of HIV infection and the effect on the immune system, along with knowledge of common clinical presentations, helps EMS personnel provide compassionate and competent care. Knowledge of the actual risks allows the provider to take appropriate precautions that don't interfere with providing professional and emotionally supportive care.